Okay, good evening, everyone. We are in our second last week here. So next week we're Tuesday again. And tonight...
Okay. Because the annual general meeting of the condominiums are Wednesday, the room's not available.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Tuesday night, same time, same channel. So we are now in the 20th century, the middle of the 20th century, and next week we're going to wrap up and talk about a little bit of a reflection on history and a little bit of where we are today, living here in this country, and some of the interesting features of being a Jew in a Canadian or North American society. So stay tuned for some interesting topics on that next week. This week we're going to look at the birth of the modern state of Israel and some of the challenges and issues that are associated with this moment, with this incredible moment. But before we begin, I'll start with a story which will link together last week's discussion about the events of the Shoah that we spent time looking into. And the story that I heard from one of my rabbis in yeshiva, it's a story about a Holocaust survivor named Saba Yosef. That was how he was known in his community in Israel. And Saba Yosef survived many different horrible experiences that he went through. And many times he was asked what was the most difficult day for him during his years in the war. What was his most difficult day? And he used to say to these young Israelis, young people, I'm not going to answer you, you would never understand. Whatever I would tell you, you really wouldn't get it. And this would go on for a time. And after a while, they would ask him again, and eventually he opened up, and he would say that the most difficult day for him was liberation, was the day of liberation. So the person who asked him gave this confused look. How could liberation be the most difficult day? Yesterday was they marked the end of World War II. I actually spoke to someone today who told me World War II for me ended on May the 9th, which is today. But how could liberation be such a difficult moment for you? How could that be the most difficult day of the war for you? So he said that when the army came in to liberate the camp, they brought together all of the survivors, and they started to announce different countries where survivors had come from, and some of the countries were willing to take a certain number of Jews, and they were organizing these groups together. So they would call out France, and the French Jews would gather together, and they would call out a different country, and those Jews would get together, and and then at the end, this Yosef, this Saba Yosef, who was then just Yosef, he realized that he had nowhere to go. He had no place, he had no idea of what his future would hold. And he said that was the hardest day, because he didn't know what the next day would bring for him. And so he said to the individual who asked him, you know, what was the hardest day of the war for you? And he said, I told you, you wouldn't understand. And he said in Hebrew, Ata yeled shel hamidina. You're a child who was born after the state existed. So you wouldn't understand what it is to live in a time where there was no state. You wouldn't understand what it is to live in a time where Jews literally didn't know where to go or didn't have a place to go. So it's with that we enter into this incredible moment that we just celebrated 69 years of independence last week. And the first place we go to, I think, would be the most logical place, which is the Declaration of Independence in 1948. So I just brought one snippet. And this snippet really gives you an insight into how complex Israel was and is and continues to be and will probably continue to be for eternity. Right near the end, it's actually the last part of the Declaration of Independence. And I'll just preface by mentioning that the Declaration of Independence wasn't written by one individual. It was written by a group of scholars and thinkers and rabbis from all backgrounds in Israeli society. And all these people got together, and they came up with a basic text, which has a number of components to it. For those who've ever read through the Declaration, if you've never read through it, I highly recommend it. It's not very long, and it's really fascinating. It gives you a lot of insight into what it was. You know, if you think about Israel doesn't really have their own constitution, but in many ways it represents the constitution of the state of Israel. And at the end of the the declaration, it's here in the Hebrew and the English. It reads as follows on the left side: Mitoch bitachon bitzur Yisrael, placing our trust in the Rock of Israel. Hinenu chotmim bechatimat yadenu, we affix our signatures to this proclamation. Leidura achrazazu b'mashab moetzer medina azmanit. You can hear David Ben Gurion's voice on that recording. Al admat hamoledet beir Tel Aviv hayom hazeh erev Shabbat hei iyar tafshinchet 14 b'May 1948. Session of the Provisional Council of State on the soil of the homeland in the city of Tel Aviv on this Shabbat Eve, the fifth day of iyar. 5708, which is the 14th day of May 1948. And then underneath you have all the signatures. Now what's interesting about it, if you ever have a chance to look at the original document, which they have on display in Israel, there was a great debate about whether the name of God should be included in the Declaration of Independence. And as you could imagine, there were a lot of different opinions on this question. Should we put God's name in? Many other countries have God's name in their independence documents, in their foundational documents. But the state of Israel was founded, as we've spoken about in previous weeks, by and large by a secular Zionist movement, by a secular Zionist community, and they were vehemently against any mention of religion or God in any of these documents. So what they did was they put in an ambiguous phrase called Tsur Yisrael, the Rock of Israel, which if you're a religious person, you would understand right away that the word Tsur is another name of God, is another name for Hashem, which we have many times in our prayers. The word Tsur Yisrael, we have it right before the Amidah, the Shemona Esrei, and other places as well. And if you're secular, it's referring to the land of Israel, the Tsur Yisrael. So David Ben-Gurion, that was his idea. He said, we'll put that in, and that will kind of make the religious people happy, and it will make sure that the secular are, and you can already start to hear and see how just in this document, in the very opening minutes to the founding of the modern state of Israel, some of the major issues, religious divides and stances of what the nature of this state was going to look like for eternity, and many of those types of questions carry on to this day. I put in the footnote here, David Ben-Gurion himself said in Hebrew, Nidme li shekulanu ma'aminim, we all believe, kol echad al pi darko l'fi havanato, each person according to their understanding and their approach, kol echad me'itanu l'fi darko v'havanato ma'amin b'tzur Yisrael k'fi shu mevin etzeh, however you want to interpret it, interpret it. And I'll leave it for you to interpret it. And he says, "Ein bazeh shum pkia v'shum kviya." We're not forcing anyone to think about it one way or another. And in so many ways, it's a great place to start our discussion because it puts into our minds the reality that Israel is a place of complexity, religious complexity, which is going to be a big component of our discussion here, and perhaps that's what makes things so exciting in some way. Sometimes it comes out in a negative way, but it does create a certain complexity that makes Israel and the Jewish people the diverse, colorful, and vibrant people that we are. Go ahead.
Same story for the prayer for Israel?
Say, you're talking about
conflict of opinion?
In terms of saying whether it's the redemption or not saying the prayer at all, we're gonna touch on that. Yes, that's what you might call a result or a continuation of this kind of conversation. There's a nice little photo here that I found of a cover which has a stamp from the first day of the mailing from the state of Israel, and it was actually signed by 11 of the individuals who signed on the Declaration. By the way, the people who signed on the Declaration of Independence were instructed that they were only allowed to sign their name and not put anything else on there. But if three of the rabbis who were part of the official, some of them wrote Baruch Hashem in very small scribbly. So each one tried to put their mark. And when the Declaration of Independence was translated into English, translating the word Sur Yisrael was a whole debate. How do you translate it into English? And when we write Erev Shabbat, do we write Friday? Do we write Sabbath Eve? So you can hear all these kinds of things come up when this discussion was being put forth. Now, the bottom half of the first page, I have three poems. The middle one is probably the most familiar to everyone. That's the poem of Hatikva. It's actually written in 1878 by a secular individual, Naftali Hertz Imber, who wrote it after the establishment of Petach Tikva. It was like what you might call a celebratory poem that was written. It wasn't in the full form that we have it today, but this poem, because it became so famous and so important, even in those early years, in late 19th century, the World Zionist Congress in 1897, which we spoke about a few weeks ago, took it on as their anthem. So that kind of set the stage for Hatikva to become, later on, the official national anthem of the State of Israel. One other interesting note about Hatikva is that Rav Kook, also wrote, and he wasn't the only one, also wrote what he wanted to be called the national anthem. What you may notice, if you've ever paid attention to the Hatikva, there's no mention of God, there's no mention of Torah, there's no mention of religion, and it's a national anthem of the Jewish state, which is kind of strange when a significant percentage of the state has religious people living there. And there are many who won't sing the song because it doesn't have those references. So Rav Kook wrote his own version with more religious overtones. It never became popular enough to become as famous as this one. But you start to understand a little bit about how the seeds of some of these issues and some of these conflicts were developed, not in 1948, but starting even further back. Go ahead.
Not exact.
No, it's not exact.
No,
line two yeah, should be line you're right.
One.
That's true.
Line one should be line two.
That's right.
Also, just on that point, Effie, about the idea that it doesn't have Hashem's name in it, but it does have prophetic allusions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it does bring out of Tanakh something, like a law of Tatikvatina. Like, you know, Eretz Sion of Yerushalayim, right? The idea of Zion, which is quoted
yeah. Yeah, there's no question that it's influenced by Tanakh. Around the same time, if you look in the right column, and this is not the full text, I encourage everyone to go on and see it. It's a really beautiful poem. We spoke about this individual a few weeks ago, Chaim Nachman Bialik, who was the one who spoke about the new Jew. He wrote the poem we read a few weeks ago in the City of Slaughter after the Kishinev pogrom, and he said the Jews have to get out of Europe and we have to stop being passive. So even before that, before he was famous, in 1891, one of his first poems called El Hatzipor, and it's a beautiful poem where he writes basically a conversation which he has with an imaginary bird. And this bird is going to Palestine, is going to the land of Israel, and he wants the bird to report back. What do you see in the land? Is it better there than it is here in Russia? I hope so. And he goes on in this poem very beautifully and poetically. A few tunes have been written to this poem. It's much longer than I gave you here, but I wanted to just share a few of the pieces. Do you bring greetings from my fellows in Sion, from my brothers near and far? Oh, happy ones, surely they must know that I suffer, or how I suffer in pain. And he goes on to talk about the plight of the Jews in Europe, in Eastern Europe, and where he was living. And to dream, this Zionist dream, in the late 19th century, of being able to one day, maybe not him, but the Jewish people, be able to one day fulfill that dream. And then, of course, probably most famous in terms of pre-state literature, was a poem written by a poet, Natan Alterman, called Magash HaKesef. In English, the silver platter. It's here on the left. If anyone looks at the date at the bottom, you'll see December 19th, 1947. You wonder to yourself, what was the context of this poem? So he was not the first person to use the phrase silver platter. That coin was phrased by Chaim Weizmann after the partition plan of November 1947. Chaim Weizmann came out and said, the state will not be given to the Jewish people on a silver platter. We're going to celebrate the partition, but we know that we're going to have to fight. We know that this is not going to be simple. And a few days later, Chaim Weizmann said that early December, and a few days later, Natan Alterman wrote this poem. In Israel, the students have to memorize this poem in Hebrew. And it's really about the story of these two young pioneers who die for the cause, for the Zionist cause, to be able to have a state. And, you know, and it's this image of them presenting the state to the people. A lot of people think that this poem, without knowing about the dating, that it was written in a modern context, that it was written as looking back on what type of sacrifice had to go into the establishment of the state, but really it was written as a prophecy, as a prophetic kind of prediction of what was to come and what kinds of things the Jews were going to have to endure to be able to have a state of their own. And that's how it's a very tragic poem, and it's a very haunting poem. People usually reference it around the time of Yom HaZikaron to talk about the sacrifice that had to be made to bring this state to fruition. So let's look at some of the reactions of the rabbinic community. And we can often get muddled down and lost in what we might call the 21st century discourse, where we hear, you know, you may visit Israel, and you may get one feeling when you're in one part of Israel or one community of Yerushalayim or one, you know, reading one news outlet is going to give you one perspective, and a different news outlet is going to give you an entirely different perspective. Looking at the early stories of this will kind of open up our eyes to a little bit more of some of the seeds of what we see today, but also a little bit more of a simpler perspective. I have here side by side, it's very hard to read the left side, what you see if you ever journey to Mea She'arim, you'll see these signs all over the walls. They're called Pashkashvilim. Pashkashvilim, it's a whole business. They announce people who great rabbis who've passed away, and they announce all kinds of different rallies and protests, and it's all cherems, all kinds of stuff that they want to announce to their community. And these go up on the walls. Baruch Dayan Emes, you'll see these big signs. So that's kind of an iconic image that you think of when you think of that neighborhood or some of those neighborhoods. And on the left side, you have a public declaration against the State of Israel, which came out in 1947 by the Eda HaCharedit in Israel. And I'll just read one line here that I can actually make out. It's somewhere in the middle there. It says as follows. Where was I looking? He said, "Achilul Shem Shemayim, the Elbon HaTorah HaKadosha, the shame of the Torah, Yesh Be'etzem." Recognizing the state, and it's a kfira, and it goes on to really go out very strongly against this declaration. These are people living there. This wasn't coming from people outside of the country. On the right side, you have an announcement from the Histadrut Poalei Agudat Yisrael, Be'eretz Yisrael. Now, the Poalei Agudat Yisrael was a trade union and a Jewish political party which started in Poland, and it was a minor political party. They were part of Ben Gurion's government. As I mentioned, 1922 in Lodz, this was started as a workers' affiliate of the Agudas Yisrael of Poland. Now, those who are familiar with Agudas Yisrael, it's not necessarily from the secular, and it's not necessarily from the from the religious Zionists. It's coming from an ultra-Orthodox workers' political party. And they had people who were represented in the Polish government, and that was the purpose of it then, you know, in the years before the state when it was established in Poland. But they seem to have been, if you look here on the document here, Nes Ha'atzma'ut. And this was in 1949, and they were calling for a party for the first celebration for the one-year anniversary of the establishment of the state. So this was a document that was pasted around. And what I wanted to show with these two pieces next to each other is people kind of give a blanket statement about what the ultra-Orthodox community believes or believed about the state. There are people in every community who view Israel with negative views and with positive views. Maybe it's a majority in one community, maybe it's a minority in a different community. But it's important to go back and to see how it's not black and white. It's not just one way and one perspective. And there were definitely people and leaders in some of these communities who took the perspective that this is something that we have to recognize, this is something that we have to celebrate. Whether or not everybody would agree with that in those communities was a different story, but coming out in favor of this is something that is very interesting to look at. Go ahead. Yeah, there was that example of Yom HaTzmud or Yom Yerushalayim. Definitely these stories, legends, or real of different individuals in communities that we might label as being against these kinds of things that do recognize the great miracles in one way or another. We'll get more into that question in a few moments. So here's just a few examples, a few samplings from different rabbinic leaders. The bottom, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, who was actually the chief rabbinic authority for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. He was an expert in medical law, medical Jewish law, medical halacha. And he talks about here in the bottom piece on the second page, he talks about here how the fact that we have a state of our own where we can rule, we can govern, isn't just important because we can have a government and because we can have an army, we can defend ourselves. There's a halachic, there's a new reality of being able to keep the Torah in a new way, to keep the Torah in a way that we haven't been able to for 2,000 years. New areas of Jewish law that we haven't ventured into, and he talks here about the laws of Mashiach, and Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, most people would not consider him in the camp of, you know, the religious Zionists or a good friend of the secular Zionists. He was very much so in the Haredi community. He wasn't pro a mandatory draft. He felt, we're going to talk about army service in a few moments, he didn't think that was something that people studying Torah full-time should be a part of. So he had views that were not necessarily in line with all the views of the government, but he's looking at the state from a different perspective than other people are looking at it, as an opportunity. I have here, now we're starting with the numbers. And source number one, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook gave a speech in 1967. You remember, we're going to celebrate Yom Yerushalayim, I think just under 2 weeks, and 50 years of reunification of Jerusalem, an amazing, amazing moment in history. So 1967, one month before, right? He's, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook is talking, and he's giving this speech, and he says, 19 years ago, in 1948, when we received the positive decision of the world powers regarding the establishment of the State of Israel, as everyone went out to the streets to publicly, by the way, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook was the son of Rav Cook. A lot of things he continued on from his father, and many things he did not. There were a lot of differences between them as well. He was very famous in the movement called the Gush Emunim. So a lot of the communities that we know today, Gush Etzion and that whole area, Efrat, actually was later, but that whole area that was developed after 1967 was very much from his encouragement. So he writes, as everyone went out to the streets to publicly celebrate the feelings of joy, I could not go out and participate with them. I sat alone and silent as my energy was sapped. And this is Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who was heading the Yeshiva at Merkaz Harav, which is the center of religious Zionist Torah learning in Israel, in the world, in many ways. And he says, I couldn't celebrate in 1948. I sat alone, same first hours. I couldn't agree what was occurring. Yes, you know, it's true. The word of Hashem is unfolding before us. The prophecies in my land, they shall divide. Where is our Hebron? Are we forgetting it? Where is our Transjordan? All these areas of Israel that we're not getting. Is it really in our hands to relinquish, to give up on a millimeter of it? Heaven utterly forfend this. And then he writes in the Hebrew, Baruch Hashem zachinu v'zochim anu af ata. L'kayem devar Hashem ha'idei tifer gvurat tzava'enu. We've been lucky to accomplish something new. Nesakem b'kitzra, shilton yudi b'eretz ha'kodesh kri, medina yisov v'tzva'a, yachad im yoto b'b'chinur keitz megolar v'mitzveh mefereshe v'chashva mitzvah kol yisraelit. And he goes on to talk about how until we have everything that was promised to us, we're not there yet. And this question of not there yet comes back to this issue of, so how do we celebrate Yom HaTzmaut? Do we celebrate Yom HaTzmaut? Do we celebrate this moment in history as we've made it? We've made it, and now we can sit back on our laurels and everything's going to be okay? Or is there still work to be done? Or is there still a lot more that needs to be accomplished and fulfilled? Rav Ovadia Yosef, who was Sephardic chief rabbi for many years and just passed away a number of years ago, one of the great halachic authorities for the Sephardic world. You will not hear a Sephardic rabbi or book go through a whole book without quoting Rav Ovadia Yosef. He's very central in this community in our day, and he writes a whole long answer to the question of whether or not we should say Hallel with a bracha. He agrees we should say Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut, but he doesn't believe we should say it with a bracha. Saying it with a bracha would mean that we have arrived at the final moment of the redemption. Because the Hallel that we're supposed to say is thanking Hashem for the miracle that happened. But the bracha on the Hallel is a affirmation that we realize that all the dreams of what this redemption is supposed to look like have come to fruition. And he doesn't believe we've arrived there. Does he believe we're at the beginning? Maybe, but he definitely doesn't believe we're at the close to the end. And if you look here, some of his comments on the right side, he says, "Va'afkan." I'm in the end of the first line. "Afkan" in source number two. "Hare manhige tzvaot Arav," all the Arab armies. "Lamrod hatvusot," and he's writing not in the early years of the state. He's probably writing a few years later. "Lamrod hatvusot v'mapalot shenachalu." We beat them. We had a lot of victories against them. "Odam me'aymim hashkeim va'arev." They're still waiting. If we would put our guns down for one day, we know exactly what would happen. "Latzeit lemilchama negdenu." "U'menafnefim b'charvoteim." And they wave their swords and their bows. "Charvam tavo b'libam v'kashtotam d'shaberna." "Ani shalom." We want peace. "Chi adaber heima lemilchama." They just talk about war. "V'kama medinot ne'orot." Here he's knocking on the enlightened nations of the world. We're talking before about certain countries turning their backs on Israel. He says, "Shehayu nechshavot k'yediditiyon l'Israel," people that we thought were our friends. "Panu oref," they turned their back on us. "V'lo panim b'melchama shavru aleinu," they didn't help us at a time of need. "Melchamet ha'komemiyut," Mivsa Kodet, Mivsa Kadesh, the Sinai campaign. "Chemet sheshir yamim," Melchamet ha'hatasha. "V'achron ichbid," Melchamet yom ha'kipurim. So he's already writing after 73, this discussion. He says, we had to fight on our own. We had to do it all on our own. Everybody said, you know, we'll help you, we'll help you, we'll help you. And then we had to go at it on our own. So, lo shavati, lo shakatati, v'lo nachti, v'yavo rokes. The first thing that Rav Ovadia Yosef says, we're not done with our physical threats. And to think that we've achieved redemption when there are still people who are trying to destroy us, that's not called redemption. Odeinu tichlene neno yisho Yisrael miti. We're waiting for that day. We should be zocha to that day. Ulei Hashem she'alanu azaychim ba'unu. Okay, that's physical. What about spiritual? He says we're very far away from where we could be spiritually as a people, as a country. Umibchina ruchanit, five lines from the bottom on the right side. Sheyarud yaradnu elef ma'alot achoronim. We've dropped down so far in spirituality, religiosity, and we're witness to the to the to the throwing off of the Torah, of the observance, choser tzniut, the immodest dress, and he goes on, he talks about the movies and everything that's going on in society, breaking Shabbos in public, chilul Shabbat b'farhesia, people are opening up non-kosher restaurants. How could this go on in the state of Israel? You know, rhetorical questions. And he says, obviously we haven't arrived at the moment that the prophet spoke about. And yes, it's true. You know, he goes on, he says, and he talks about the education system, so much secular education, and they're teaching children to hate, you know, to hate the religious people, so on and so forth. So he feels, we say Hallel, it's something that we should celebrate, it's something we should be amazed and proud and sing, but with caution, because there's still work to be done. A few more perspectives on this. Rav Yehuda Amital, who also just passed away a number of years ago, who was the head of the yeshiva in Har Etzion, and he was a co-head with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who also another great Torah giant, who also passed away in the past few years. He was a Holocaust survivor. It's an unbelievable story about him. And these two Rosh yeshivas had very opposing views, and this is a religious Zionist yeshiva. So this is within the religious Zionist camp. Rav Amital went in the path of Rav Kook, and he went in the path of Rav Kook's students, Rav Charlap and Rav Kook's son, and he felt that the state of Israel is Reishit Tzmichat Gulatenu. It's the beginning of this great moment of a new stage of history. And his co-Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Lichtenstein, he didn't agree with him. He was skeptical. And he said, if you look on the right side, he was a student of Rav Soloveitchik, who was, we know, in Yeshiva University. He was a son-in-law. And Rav Soloveitchik's teachings never spoke to him, Rav Amital. Rav Lichtenstein, as a disciple of Rav Soloveitchik, was skeptical of characterizing the state as the beginning of redemption. Addressing the messianic atmosphere that prevailed after the Six-Day War, he frequently told students in a somewhat cynical tone that he had not seen Mashiach roaming the streets of Jerusalem. So, an anecdote. There's obviously a lot more to analyze in the writings of Rav Soloveitchik about religious Zionism in Israel, but you understand, even within, as I said before, within different communities, different views are held, and it's not just black and white. I put here in the bottom one of the Haredi perspectives brought down in a beautiful book on Torah and Zionism, HaTkufa HaGdolah, which was written also after the Six-Day War. He talks about the Midrash that many here may be familiar with, why we don't say a full Hallel on the seventh day of Pesach. Seventh day of Pesach, we read the Shirat Hayam, the Az Yashir, the Song of the Sea that the Jews sang when they crossed through the split sea after the Egyptians were drowned. So God says in the Midrash, he says that the reason why we have a half hallel is because the Egyptians were drowning. There was death at the end of the day, and we don't want to be fully joyous. So he writes here that the people who didn't want to say Hallel on Yom HaTzma'ut, they used this Midrash. They said, Ma'aseh Yadai, which means my creations. He's referring to the secular Jews in Israel, are drowning in the sea, and you want to sing? This is what God said to the angels. He says, you can't sing, my creations are drowning in the sea. Drowning in the sea is the metaphor for the assimilation of in society, of leaving Torah observance. So, it's complex. And let's look at two issues that come out of this complexity. One issue here is the issue of the draft to the army. Go ahead.
Last week in Yom HaTzma'ut, Armenian, for whatever reason, there was confusion. So what is the official opinion of the Ashkenazic Rabbanut and the Sephardic Rabbanut of Israel today?
So the chief rabbinate in 1948 established that Hallel should be said without a bracha in 1948. Hallel should be said. And part of the reason why they didn't say we should say it with the bracha is because 5% of world Jewry was living in Israel then. It was not an event. It was an event that was important in Jewish history, but didn't impact world Jewry in the way that, let's say, 1967, where there were already 3 million Jews living in Israel, and they changed their tune. In 1974, when Israel was more secure, when things were a little bit more stable in the country, they said, changed the halachic decision. And they said, now you should say challah with a bracha. So anyone who follows the, who values or feels that the opinion of the chief rabbin is something we should listen to, that's the official state opinion. And you might call the yeshiva, you know, the yeshivot hezder and the religious Zionist community, they follow the chief rabbinate. Many other communities follow the chief rabbinate. So a lot of the communities outside of Israel, depending on who's the leader of the shul, depending on the tradition of the shul, it's, you're going to find every permutation on Yom HaAtzmaut.
Is the OU or RCA on it?
I'm not familiar. It's a good question. So let's look at these two examples. So the first example is the question of the draft. And in 1958, which is 10 years after the founding of the state, there was an exchange of letters between Rabbi Yitzhak Herzog, or Yitzhak Halevi Herzog, who was the first chief rabbi after the state was declared, and he was the chief rabbi for 11 years before he passed away. He has a lot of people who ended up going into politics from his family, and he has a very interesting life, and I'll just tell one short anecdote about him. In May 1939, for those who remember this part of the story, just before, a few years before the, just before World War II, the British put out something called the White Paper. The White Paper was a restriction on Jewish immigration to Palestine in 1939, which is unbelievable to think about the context of that. So after leading a procession through the streets of Yerushalayim with an unusually united Jewish following, Rabbi Herzog, on the steps of the Churva Synagogue, we mentioned it last week, he turned and said, we cannot agree to the white paper, and remember who was ruling at that time in Palestine, so obviously this was a very public act of defiance. Just as the prophets did before me, I hereby rip it in two. And he ripped up the white paper. 40 years later, November 1975, his son, who was Ambassador Herzog, he was actually the ambassador to Canada, he repeated his father's gesture and he ripped up the UN resolution that said Zionism is racism. So, like father, like son. Rabbi Herzog was very famous for bringing a lot of Jews' children, we all have a story in our own family, from Europe to Israel to different countries to help them get out of those places. Now, this exchange is important because in 1948, David Ben-Gurion didn't want Menachem Begin to be part of his coalition because they did not see eye to eye on anything, or basically anything. So he needed more parties to join him to get more seats. So he brought a lot of religious parties into his, it was a very interesting government at the beginning of the state. I think there were four religious parties that David Ben-Gurion had in his first government. Two of them were from the religious Zionist camp, and two of them were from the Haredi camp. And in those early years, the Haredi politicians took advantage of the fact that they were in the government and Ben-Gurion needed them, and they made some deals about exempting Torah yeshiva students from army service. That was in 1948. So that original exemption, which I think was for 600 students, that was the original exemption. Today is like, I think, 60,000 or something. I don't remember the exact number, but it's a very large number. And just from that moment, you see how that impacted, you know, the rest of the history of the State of Israel to this day, which is still obviously a very hotly debated topic. So there was a letter in 1958 which went back and forth between the chief rabbi and David Ben-Gurion about extending the exemption. I guess there must have been some limitation on how long the exemption was going to go on for, and David Ben-Gurion wanted to force the yeshiva students to do basic training, at the very least, to learn how to, you know, to shoot a rifle and to go through some kind of basic training, just in case we need more soldiers for a war. In 1958, we know that there were a lot more Jews living in Israel than there were in 1948. All of the Jews that came from the Muslim countries and so on, the Aliyot, from the various countries that brought in when those Jews were kicked out of their countries brought in huge numbers. So I'm not going to go through exactly what it, the letters are much longer than what I have here, but you can look in the side, just the highlight points. In Rabbi Herzog's letter, he talks about how our whole purpose, the religious community here in Israel, their entire purpose is to rebuild the lost Torah and the lost Torah communities that were destroyed by the fires of the Holocaust. And this is our responsibility, and this is the charge of those who were murdered to our generation. And that's what we have to focus on, and that has to be our focus. And when you hear it, it's a very strong and compelling argument. We're living 13 years after the end of the war and the decimation of communities. We spoke a little bit about it last week. And he talks about Hitler, Yamach Shemo. He knew that our strength was in our spirit, and that's what he wanted to destroy. That's why they went after the Torah scrolls in the 1930s and Kristallnacht and the other events of book burnings and burning Sfarim and shuls and all of that. That was even before the war began. And he writes that we have this responsibility. And then he says at the end, he says, don't think that just because we're sitting in yeshiva, we're not playing a part in the war effort. Or we're not playing a part in supporting those who are fighting. He says, our Torah learning is also a protection, is a form of protection. Agree or disagree, this is the perspective of Rabbi Herzog. He felt that the exemption had to be maintained. David Ben-Gurion wrote back a fiery, fiery letter. And in his letter, he has a number of points. The first thing that he says is, a lot has changed in 10 years, as I mentioned before. There were far fewer yeshiva students back then. Now we're dealing with thousands. We're into the thousands at that point, who are studying Torah full time. And he talks about, over and over, this theme of, we have a Jewish state and we have to protect ourselves, and the only ones who can protect us is us. When we lived in another country, the non-Jews didn't need Jewish people to protect them. But we need Jews to protect other Jews. And it's very hard for me, and this is his strongest line, I think, of the whole thing, to tell one mother that she has to send her son off to battle, while another mother, her son can go and sit in the yeshiva and in the secure yeshiva. How can I, as the leader of this country, ethically, morally, say that to an individual? I can't. And fascinating, Ben-Gurion was a very secular person. He knew Tanakh, and he knew certain halacha as well. Anybody who's ever visited in the south, to David Ben-Gurion's house, he has Sfarim on his bookshelves. Those are things that he owned. The Rambam, he has a Gemaras, he has Tanakh. Very interesting. He was a very learned person. Whether he lived that life is a different story. And he quotes the Rambam in his letter to the chief rabbi. He says, you must know the Rambam. The Rambam says that in a war of life or death, everybody goes out to war. Even a groom on the day of his wedding. And he quotes this in his letter to Rabbi Herzog. And he goes on. He says, I never found anywhere in the whole Tanakh an exemption for people to go from war. Pikuach Nefesh, and he brings all these different references. It's very, very, very interesting story. And in the end, David Ben-Gurion lost, and the exemption was kept in place.
I heard Herzog objected to, and there was actual war of students fighting.
So he writes, so actually David Ben-Gurion says that the yeshiva students were very involved in 1948 in the War of Independence. So if they're not trained in basic training, how are they going to, if they need bodies, they need bodies. But as the army grew, you know, that's part of the debate today. Is it about bringing that community into the army because they don't really need them? The army today is much more advanced, much more technology. They don't need as many bodies in the army as they used to. But then it was much more about the numbers and the people and the bodies in the army. So it's an ongoing issue. Let's look at a second point here, and we'll try to wrap things up in the next few minutes. The law of return, which was also part of David Ben-Gurion's initiatives to infuse the state with huge numbers of immigration. He passed in Knesset the law of return, the Chok HaShvut, which is actually really part of the Declaration of Independence. Declaration of Independence says very clearly that we're establishing a Jewish state with a Jewish character. And part of that Jewish character is that every Jew has the right to become a citizen in Israel upon their arrival to get that citizenship. There were two amendments made to this. One amendment was the amendment of a child gets automatic citizenship, even if they're a child of a intermarriage. So if one of the spouses is not Jewish, child or grandchild can get automatic citizenship. And there was a third amendment for conversions that were not Orthodox conversions. That was in 1989. So I've had amendments to this over the last number of years, and people are starting to think of all the stories they know and have heard of that are related to this. There are obviously many, many stories. There's the story of the Aliyah from Iraq. There's a little stamp here on the right side. It's called Aliyat Ezra Nehemiah, Operation Ezra Nehemiah, which brought close to 130,000 Iraqi Jews from Iraq after the problem started there after 1948. And there was a big problem in Iraq because a lot of these Jews were wealthy, educated. It created a big economic issue there. But obviously for Israel, it was very, very beneficial to their country. So one of the big questions that came up from the countries that were bringing Jews in was the question of the Ethiopian Jews, also known as the Falasha. Without having enough time to go into it in depth, you have a whole group of letters here. Again, Rabbi Herzog was very involved in this. In this question, Rav Avadia Yosef, who we mentioned before, was very involved in this question. And part of the question was, do we have any knowledge that the Ethiopian community, who I think we actually spoke about like at the beginning of our classes maybe 2 months ago, that was the Yemenite, no, not the Ethiopians, that maybe they were descendants of one of the tribes, one of the lost tribes, the tribe of Dan, in specific, is mentioned in very early Tshuvot, from a few hundred years ago. So there's a lot of different issues with this. Some people weren't sure. Some people said when they come, they all have to go through conversion, and not full conversion, but at least go in the mikvah. And Rav Avadia Yosef felt we have if the rabbis of our tradition told us that they come from the tribe of Dan, we should trust them. We should rely on them. So feel free to look at some of these things on your own. But just to conclude, and then we'll take comments. We'll just conclude, and then we'll take comments. One of the kind of larger questions, which I want to just end off with, is the question of how does the state of Israel, the founding of the modern state of Israel, impact the Jewish people as a new era of maybe what you might call religious life or Torah life? And part of it is the question that Rav Kook spoke about and others spoke about here in source number 10 of what he calls Torat Eretz Yisrael and Torat HaGalut. And essentially, he talks about this idea that Galut is very much about the individual. Even if it's not so much about the individual, it's about the community. But it's not so much about the nation. It's not so much about the national idea of the Jewish people. Living outside of Israel has a certain nature to it, which causes us to focus on the particulars of mitzvot, the details of mitzvot, and not the broader, bigger ideas of what you might call, you know, the institutions of the Jewish people, the Sanhedrin, the idea of a monarchy, of a Jewish monarchy, which we know we've had in our history. Just think of the books of Nevi'im, of the books of Kings, and these other books where it talks about what it was to have a Jewish homeland with Jewish sovereignty. And we're coming back to a time like that. So Torat Eretz Yisrael, in a way, is governed by a very different kind of understanding, a very different kind of approach, and that is going to affect everything. We I think mentioned a few weeks back about the issue of the Heter Mechira when it came time for the Shemitah, and all these farmers wouldn't know what to do if they wouldn't have an ability to sell their lands to the Arab locals, because they were shipping their produce out of the country and whatever the situation was, and they would basically lose that land if they wouldn't be able to continue benefiting from it during the year of Shemitah. And one of the things that we mentioned at the time is that one of the reasons why they might be allowed to do this is that Shemitah in the modern era is only a rabbinic injunction. Part of it is dependent on majority of the Jewish people living in Israel. Now, I don't know if anyone saw the recent statistics. They put them out every year, a census of world Jewry. I don't know who runs these numbers or who figures it out. But the numbers this year were 14.1 million Jews in the world, give or take whatever margin of error. In Israel alone, it's close to, out of that number, almost 47%. So we're getting up to almost half of world Jewry is living in the state of Israel. And you ask the question of, well, what difference does it make? How many Jews are living there? It will make certain differences, certain halakhic questions, and certain issues of how we deal with majority of the Jewish people being there as opposed to being spread around the world. Probably in our day and age, we will see that come to fruition. And in the last source, I brought here a poem, which I'll finish with. This is written by somebody I have a personal relationship with, somebody I'm very close with, who wrote a book about his life. His name is Rabbi Meir Moskowitz. He's a Holocaust survivor. He lives in New York. And he's someone who has literally lived 1,000 lives. Unbelievable life story, which he writes about in his book. Half the book is his life story, and the other half he writes these poems about all kinds of different experiences. So he writes a poem called Bikur uBikoret, which is a play on the words, but Bikur means to visit, Bikoret means criticism. So comes from the same kind of sound, but what he wants to do here is talk about how his visits to Israel leave him longing for something that he feels he doesn't have the strength to do. And I'll finish with this and a little bit of a thought-provoking poem for everyone. So he writes, Kitayar, as a tourist, Ba ani zu pam rishona. I come to you, I come my first time, Elecha Yisrael Hamidina. It actually rhymes, so it's good to read two lines at a time. I come to you, Israel the state. Arachshav bikarticha midei shana, betokev tafkid bar mitzvah chatuna. Until now, I have visited you every year for something for work, or for a simcha, for a wedding, for a bar mitzvah. Kasher bikarticha, ayafti, yagati, hitzatzti, v'nifgati. When I visited you, I longed for you, I had an amazing time. B'tiskul v'achsava mimcha yetzeti. And I left with this feeling of longing, of confusion, of pain almost. What I was hoping for, what I was longing in you, I did not find. Every time I left you, hirgashti ashem, al shelo natati lechalomi lehitgashem. I felt ashamed that I didn't let my dreams become fulfilled, come to fruition. Lehityashev ba'aretz ketoshav ukeezrach. Lo lashevet al sir habasar velomar libi bamizrach. So he's giving himself criticism. He says to live in the land, my dream, to live there like a citizen, as a dweller, and not to sit on my pot of meat. And here he's referencing the Jews when they were in the desert, reminiscing the good days when they were slaves in Egypt, that they got to have their pot of meat. And just to say, my heart is in the east, which is a reference to my heart is in Israel. Libi shasua upatsua. My heart is torn and wounded. Vani odea lama umadua. And I know why. Ki eneni yachol lehitgaber al chulsha shel nochiyut hagalut. Vani malei busha. I can't overcome the weakness, my weakness, of the niceties of living in galut. And I'm filled with busha, with embarrassment, with shame. Life outside of Israel, I can intellectualize, I can justify. And But despite all this, my heart longs, my heart is sad. How do I find the strength to find an answer to my question? Ulai hapam, maybe this time, bevoi imrayati, when I come with my wife, I don't know what year he wrote this in, mekor oshri v'simchati, the source of my happiness, my joy, er rakate yafe v'hatov, hanimtza becha, alaf hakol larov, I'll see the beauty and the good that's in you, despite everything that I've been through. So, some closing thoughts. It's an interesting poem, and I think it brings together a lot of the thoughts and the feelings we all have, especially when we celebrate these days of the year, these days of history, which inspire us, which make us have those feelings of longing, have those feelings of connectedness. And it's important for all of us to learn about this, to think about it, to mark these days, and to make as much effort as we can to think about the ways that we connect ourselves, the battle for the soul of Israel. Where are we in that battle? Where do we stand? It's not black and white, as we said, but it's definitely continues to inspire us, and it definitely calls to us to be part of this time of history. So we should be zoche, we should merit to many more years of Medinat Yisrael and many more years of the continuation of this incredible miracle that we are living through, to appreciate it, to celebrate it, and to pray for the ultimate redemption.
Amen.
Woo.
Good question.
Excellent.
Thank you. If Israel's a Jewish